KaiserNetwork.org.
My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, our vice chairman, Bill Frist, our soon-to-be co-chairman, Susan Collins, and the rest of our board of directors to a briefing. I guess you could call it a fresh approach to an old problem. The problem, too many Americans are without health insurance or access to adequate health care. The approach, efforts by individual states to try to deal with the uninsured on their own terms rather than waiting for some national solution. Now, it's not as if states haven't been working on a bunch of problems, including reducing the ranks of the uninsured. Before this, it's been almost 75 years since Louis Brandeis noted that a single courageous state can serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments at relatively low risk to the rest of us. But some of these new state-level efforts are creative and ambitious, promising, and worthy of some further examination. Now, last spring, the Alliance looked at the emerging Massachusetts Reform Plan, which has the potential to reach near universal coverage. Today, we're going to revisit that plan, along with those being tried in Utah and Vermont, to get a flavor of the kinds of approaches that are in the mix. And we are looking for lessons to be learned when and if a national effort to address the questions of the uninsured and cost and quality is mounted, as well as to learn what states can try emulating the efforts of other states. Our partner in today's program is the Commonwealth Fund, a private philanthropy whose work stresses the need for a healthcare system that performs at a high level, especially for the most vulnerable segments of our society, including access to healthcare and healthcare coverage. And we're very pleased to have with us Ann Gauthier, who embodies that goal, actually, as the Senior Policy Director for Commonwealth's Commission on a High Performance Healthcare System. Ann, why don't I turn to you now and get your introductory remarks.
Thank you, Ed. I am delighted to be here, and we at the Commonwealth Fund are delighted to co-sponsor with the Alliance for Health Reform, but I think it will be a fascinating briefing today. I'd like to just say a few words about our Commission on a High Performance Health System. I think Ed's laid out its goals well. We seek to move the United States. We're talking about the entire United States when we talk about a healthcare system as opposed to some of the fine healthcare organizations in it. We talk about them too. But we're looking to improve better access, improve quality, greater efficiency, with a particular emphasis on those who are most vulnerable. Some of you, I hope many of you, may be aware that the Commission has issued two major reports this summer and fall. We issued a framework statement that defines what we mean by high-performance health system for the United States and a scorecard that measures our performance against the best that has been achieved. We call for some broad recommendations for improving performance, including, importantly for this briefing, guaranteeing affordable health insurance coverage for all, increasing transparency and reporting on quality and costs, expanding the use of interoperable information technology, and encouraging public-private collaboration to achieve more effective change. States can and are playing a major role in each of these areas, and you'll hear a little bit more about that. The Commission has conceptualized a high-performance health system. Importantly, in our framework and our scorecard, we've defined it along 10 dimensions that are lumped here into five key areas. The overarching goal is that we live long, healthy, and productive lives, but the intersection of these shows the importance of not looking only at coverage, but wrestling with areas of quality and efficiency as well. And this is the states you will hear from today recognize this, and that is critical. Let me show you. I can't get away without some data. Let me show you just one picture relevant to the coverage focus today. If you look at this picture, which shows the proportion of the uninsured in 1999, 2000, and then again 2004, 2005, which is the latest data we have, I think if you were an epidemiologist, you would take a look at this and think we have an epidemic as we seem to lose states who have low rates of uninsured and gain states who have high rates. The dark blue states here are those that have 23% of their under 65 population that's uninsured, and this is up from, there are 12 states today, this is up from 4 states just 5 years ago. Finally, I'd like to pique your interest in the Commonwealth Fund State Innovations Program, which is designed to evaluate and promote the spread of best practices on all these dimensions. I show you here some projects that are evaluations and other studies in progress. This is a work in progress. We are looking at Massachusetts. We are looking at Maine. We are looking across all 50 states at the policies and practices that would impede or promote high performance, both. And we have a quarterly, soon to be bi-monthly, newsletter, States in Action, that I encourage you to sign up for. Some of these projects are in partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation as well. And we seek to learn from what my colleagues at this table are doing and to provide that information not only to other states but to Congress so that we can make some faster progress. And with that, I'd like to turn it back to Ed to introduce our speakers.
Very good. Thank you, Ann. Before I do that, let me just handle a couple of logistical items with which you will be familiar if you've been to many of our briefings. You see that the briefing is being webcast. It'll be available tomorrow morning on kaisernetwork.org. On both that website and the Alliance website, allhealth.org, you'll be able to get all of the materials that you find in your packets electronically. You will find in those packets more extensive biographical information than I'll be able to cover in the short time that I have. And finally, blue and green, blue evaluation form, green question card, both very important. Please use them at the appropriate times. So we have a distinguished line of speakers today. Let's get started. And we're going to start where we left off in May, actually, with Amy Lichko. Amy is both the commissioner of the Massachusetts Division of Healthcare Finance and Policy and its director of healthcare policy within the Executive Office of Health and Human Services Department there. She's been one of the key architects of Governor Romney's reform plan. Now she's charged with implementing the compromise plan that emerged from the negotiations among the governor and the Democratic legislators and the many stakeholders in that Massachusetts health system. And we're anxious to hear how that's coming. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here. I was working on this presentation over the weekend, whittling it down from 29 slides, which are contained in your packet, down to about 10. And my 10-year-old son was working on a first oral presentation for school where he had to come up with 2 minutes of words on a book that he recently read. And I said, I assured him that my job was far more difficult than his coming up with 2 minutes. What I'm going to do today is give you a really brief overview of the Massachusetts Healthcare Reform Bill and then provide you with some information and implementation updates, or where we are right now and what we still have to accomplish. I think most of you have seen many of the slides that are in the packet. This was the problem that we began with when Governor Romney came on board back in 2004. When we started looking at this problem, we had about 460,000 uninsured in Massachusetts, and we were noticing double-digit insurance premium rate hikes like everyone else across the country. Businesses were dropping benefits nationally. We didn't notice that trend in Massachusetts, but we knew it would be coming across the country to us if we didn't do something to prevent it. It was hard for individuals and small businesses to obtain health insurance, And we were noticing that people, even though they didn't have health insurance, they were still getting care. This wasn't an issue of people out on the streets not getting the care that they needed. They were seeking care at inefficient settings like emergency rooms, and they were costing the state, it was estimated by the Urban Institute, about $1.3 billion a year in the cost of this free care. Two additional pressures that were on Massachusetts that really forced us to really take a closer look at this. One was that there were ballot initiatives that were due to come, actually for this election, that put pressure on the state that they would need to have health insurance for all residents if that ballot initiative were to pass. And we also were pressured by the federal government through a potential loss of federal funding through our IGT and DISH funding mechanism of about $385 million. So there were both practical reasons for us to look at this problem, and also the governor felt that the problem was small enough that we could actually tackle it in Massachusetts and be a place to demonstrate that we could actually achieve the results that we wanted. This was what our uninsured looked like. It was important to note that we really categorized people in three different buckets. There were people who were currently eligible for our Mass Medicaid program that were very low income. They just weren't enrolling in the program. Either they were healthy or they were choosing to seek care in emergency rooms and other places where they could get free care and weren't enrolling in a program that was really delivering better, more managed care. There was also a group of people who were actually fairly high income. They were above 300% of the federal poverty level. We call them middle income. About 40% of our uninsured fell into this category. This was a growing category, people that were making ends meet, but they didn't have a lot of extra for health insurance at the end of the day. These were people we wanted to make more affordable products available in the market and see that the market mechanisms were working properly. And then there was people sandwiched in the middle that were not eligible for our public programs, but even if affordable products were available, they wouldn't be able to purchase them. They were really the low to middle income, and we needed to provide subsidies to them. So we categorized them like this because it really wasn't one size fits all. There wasn't going to be one simple solution. We needed to think really broadly about the problem. The principles that we followed what we really wanted to accomplish were as follows. We wanted to stabilize the small group market and keep small businesses from dropping insurance. We wanted to introduce these lower-priced comprehensive health insurance products. We wanted to bring the young people into the risk pool. We wanted to have them know that it was important for them to have health insurance early on and get those healthy lives into the market. We wanted to create some sort of organizing principle or facilitator that would permit the pre-tax premium payment for people who were working. There was an unfair ruling at the federal level that created this tax benefit for people who worked for employers, and if people were buying in the non-group market, they didn't have that same benefit. So we wanted to create that benefit, which was quite a nice savings for people and would make the insurance a lot more affordable if they could pay their part of the premium on a pre-tax basis. We wanted to facilitate the purchase of insurance by part-time employees and people with multiple employers. That was, when we looked at the data, that was who was falling through the gaps. People were working full-time, but they were doing this through cobbling together several part-time jobs, none of which the employers offered them health insurance. We wanted to promote a culture of insurance and personal responsibility. This was really important to get, again, those young people in, and also just people across the board knowing that healthcare wasn't for free, that if they showed up in the emergency room, we were treating them, but that really wasn't the best way for them to be getting their care. They really needed to have a doctor. They needed to have a place where they could get their care in a more efficient setting. And we also, very importantly, wanted to control costs so that the system would be sustained. This next slide is not in your packet, and it really combines slides 6 through, say, 27 or so. It gives you the responsibility for the law, key elements, who's responsible for really different elements of the law. We knew that government had to play a major role in this. There were a couple of different roles that government was going to play. For one, we had a small Medicaid expansion, mostly to children, and we also lifted some caps on programs and brought back some benefits that, such as dental for adults, that we had excluded during tougher revenue times in Massachusetts. We were going to be responsible for this subsidized insurance packet. What did it look like? What did the benefits look like? How much subsidy were we going to provide? And the government was going to be responsible, really, for organizing that. They were going to develop and establish the connector, the facilitator for allowing this pre-tax payment of premium and really allow for better functioning of the market. Government really had to do that. Government is going to have to do uncompensated care pool reform. They have yet to do that yet, but this is where people sought free care and at hospitals and community health centers. It was government's role to really move that along. And then also the insurance reforms. That was going to be government's responsibility. The healthcare system is not off the hook. They were going to be held to quality and performance standards through this new competitive marketplace. They were going to be held, as Anne mentioned, to new levels of transparency. There's going to be a lot more information on quality and cost information available in Massachusetts. They were going to be serving more patients that have insurance, so they were going to need to be more efficient and be able to deliver that care efficiently. And there was also provisions in the law for pay-for-performance for Medicaid for the Medicaid providers. Employers, as many of you have heard, have a number of responsibilities. Probably the most important one is this mandatory cafeteria plan. They have to allow employers with more than 10 employees have to allow for their prepayment, employees to access that prepayment of their premiums. There were new anti-discrimination laws that were put in place in Massachusetts, particularly affecting small companies that are not under the ERISA laws. There was a fair share assessment, which is the 295 assessment that you hear about, that was going to be placed on employers who didn't offer fair and reasonable contributions to their employees' health insurance. And there's also a surcharge that's possible for employers that don't set up those cafeteria plans and their employees end up seeking care in the hospital. They can be charged for that care. So all of these were the employer's responsibilities through the new law. And I think some people have said we haven't been tough enough on employers, but we'll let you know that when we go out and we talk to employers across the state, they feel that we've been plenty tough enough with a number of these new laws. Then individuals, the main responsibility on individuals is individual responsibility. They really need to be able to purchase health insurance that suits their needs and use care more efficiently. And that's something that that we're working on developing exactly what that's going to look like for residents in the state. There's also, along with the responsibilities, there's benefits, and there's a lot of benefits. For government, we get to constrain healthcare costs through this new bill. We're really hopeful that that will happen. We got to retain our federal funding, which was important to us. We'll have more transparency in the system and a better functioning marketplace, all important goals of the administration. The healthcare system has much fairer reimbursement. We increased Medicaid rates for hospitals and physicians substantially through this bill, and they need to provide better quality and a transparent data to us, but they also get much fairer reimbursement, which we hope will cause less cost shifting onto the private payers and employers and ensure better care for the residents. Employers, mostly small employers, now have a more level playing field than they had before. They will be able to offer their employees more choice, more affordable options. And they'll also be able to offer their part-time workers to be able to come to this new connector for healthcare where before they needed to provide one plan for their full-time workers and part-time workers. For individuals, we hope that they will see that there's more affordable options available, that they can buy their insurance pre-tax, and that they will also have advantage of that more transparent healthcare system. So what have we done so far? This slide is in your packet, slide 28. The connector's up and running. It has a staff of about 10. The Commonwealth Care, which is the subsidized benefit package for people under 300% of the FPL, began enrollment on October 1st, 2006. We already have over 8,000 people enrolled in that health insurance plan, and we're hoping to enroll all people under 100% by January 1st. The plan begins enrolling people on a sliding scale subsidy on January 1st. Our Medicaid expansions have been implemented, our fair share and free rider regulations have been completed, and the education of employers has begun. So we've done quite a bit in the 8 months since the bill was signed, but we also have a lot left to do. One of probably the biggest questions out there for me and for the policymakers working on this is what is going to constitute credible coverage for the individual mandate? Will mini med plans count? Will high deductible plans count? What's that going to look like? What are people going to be required to have? What's the floor? There's a lot of debate about that, and I'm sure that's going to be a very contentious discussion. The specifications for what the affordable insurance benefit packages look like for people over 300% of the FPL. The merger of the non-group and small group markets has yet to occur. The rules for developing these Section 125 plans for employers has yet to happen. Anti-discrimination rules and guidance hasn't occurred. So you can see there's tons more to do, and we've really just begun. There was a recent survey done by Bob Blendon for the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation that tells us that it's pretty good news so far. About 2 months ago, I had heard that only about 1 in 10 had even heard of Massachusetts residents had even heard that we passed this new bill. But this recent survey said that 80% actually of those surveyed had heard of the law, and about a quarter of those that had heard of it knew a lot about it. Good news. We read the law, the surveyors read the law to everyone they contacted, and after people heard the law read to them, 64% of them supported the basic tenets of the law. There's more support for Medicaid expansion for kids and for the business requirement to offer than there is for the individual mandate, as might be expected. People don't like to be told what to do. The support is really across all subgroups of insured and uninsured, and even across socioeconomic status. There is some skepticism expressed about implementation, however. People don't tend to think that government can do this very well. They have Medicare Part D to remind them of things that can happen, and they're nervous about it. There's also a lot of concerns for small businesses. Many people responded that they felt this was going to be harmful to small businesses and to economic development in the state. There's continued support, I think, for this bill will really depend on affordability, the premiums, the ability to keep and constrain costs, which is clearly one of the biggest issues on the table. I'll be happy to answer questions during question and answer time.
That's terrific. Thank you, Amy. Next up is Norm Thurston, who's the lead policy analyst for Governor Jim Huntsman's initiative on health insurance for Utah's uninsured, the goal of which is to cut the number of uninsured in half in the state over the next few years. Norm came to the Utah Department of Health from the economics faculty at Brigham Young University, and he has a range of health economic topics on which he's written, and we're very pleased to have him with us today. Norm?
Thank you. Today what we want to cover is the evaluation of our Section 1115 waiver, also known as the primary care network. And you have to excuse me, I have sort of a little bit of laryngitis, so I have to sort of pause every once in a while to recover enough strength to keep going. So if I pause, it's not because I've lost my place. I'm just getting my voice back. This goes back to 1993, when then-Governor Michael Levitt, now the Secretary, created a program called HealthPrint. It was to find out exactly what was going on in the healthcare system in the state of Utah. As part of that process, they identified several specific populations who were having access issues. Most notably among all those populations was low-income working adults. He decided he wanted to do something to address those access issues for that population, but it's difficult to do something in an environment that does not support Medicaid expansions. So the solution was to provide low-income working adults with a limited benefit plan under a new program. The limited benefit plan would have no hospitalization coverage or specialty care, and it would have limits on prescriptions. So basically, it would be a primary and preventive care type of an arrangement. The theory behind this plan is that some coverage must be better than no coverage. So this is a population, and if you think about this, kind of put some faces on this. In Utah at the time, the homeless fellow living under the bridge had basically no access to health care, other than relying on some charity care and some community clinics, did not have really good access to the system. So the question was, can you take that type of a person and put them in a system where they can actually get access to care? Furthermore, it wasn't just the homeless guy living under the bridge. It was also low-income working adults, people who, for whatever reason, were stuck in dead-end minimum wage jobs and did not qualify for any public programs. How do you get them to get some access to health care? So the program, the waiver program, created two new groups of Medicaid clients, essentially. The primary care network, which was the new group, and the non-traditional Medicaid, which these days it's just easy to call them the TANF parents. That's a pretty much a direct equation there. The theory was that you could reduce the benefits slightly to the TANF parents and use the savings from that reduction to fund this limited benefit plan for the new primary care network. Since the program began in July of 2002, we've had over 50,000 Utahns have benefited from the primary care network. It's also interesting to note, if you believe in sort of how markets work, we are constantly having to close enrollment because we're very close to the cap. And when we do open enrollment, it doesn't last very long because people want to get on the program. Just try to explain a little bit about what we hope to accomplish with this program. The basic idea is simple. Slightly reduced benefits for some, not major drastic cuts for some, just slight reduction in benefits, and use those savings to provide a significant benefit to low-income adults who would otherwise have no access to the healthcare system. Following up on that, if you provide them, you now you have to decide, do you want to provide them with primary care or catastrophic care? The theory was that by providing them with access to primary care, that should result in higher quality health care. So they should be able to get preventive services, which will keep them out of the emergency room and thereby reduce costs in the system and also result in better health care outcomes. If they have chronic conditions, the primary care visits can help them keep those under control. So if they have diabetes, if they have asthma, if they have other conditions that would normally be difficult to control for somebody without regular primary care, by giving them access to primary care, you would keep their major problems under control, keep them out of the hospital, and thereby give them better care and also reduce costs at the same time. So the question is does it work? Here are some of our key findings that we're, and by the way, I should note, in your packet it's clearly noted that these are preliminary and we're still verifying all of these. So you're essentially getting a sneak peek. So if you can't really quote me on any of this because it hasn't been verified by the statisticians, but
this is all off the record anyway.
It's all off the record. Yeah, you can't say things off the record to this many people and expect it to be the case. But you should just know that there's a caveat here. We believe these are correct, but we're still going through the statistical verification to make sure the program is right. Some of the things that we have found regarding access are that the average initial enrollment span for the primary care network clients is 16.7 months, which is actually much longer than the typical Medicaid client. The percent receiving primary care visits in the first year is 76.3%. And you will notice that my comments will not be subjective. I will simply make objective comments and let you decide for yourself what you're comparing that to, because we are still working on figuring out how to establish whether this is a good thing or whether it's lacking in some way. But 76% of primary care network clients were receiving primary care in their first year of service. The average number of primary care visits in the first year was 5.6. Access is also in another sense, primary care network was meant to be a bridge, that it was something that people could be on while they were working change their socioeconomic status. So they were working from one employment status to another, or they were working on qualifying for Medicare or disability or other things. In reality, of those who left the primary care network within a couple of years, 54% of them were leaving to some other form of insurance. Of those who stayed on the program, this is an interesting feature here. We conducted a survey of those who enrolled in the first 6 months, and then we re-interviewed them after 1 year and after 2 years. If you compare the baseline, which is you ask them when they sign up, have you gotten the needed medical care in the past year? So in other words, in the year preceding coming on a primary care network, 65% of them were already getting access to primary care network. So the question was, does the primary care network do anything for them? After 1 year of being on the program, that number rises to 81%. So those are our key findings regarding access. And I think there are more findings in your packets if you want to read through those. Now let's look at quality next. One of the difficulties with this particular population is they tend to be sicker. And so quality is a difficult thing to measure, especially when you don't know what you're dealing with. So we started by measuring who it was that was coming on the primary care network. This population had higher rates of arthritis, diabetes, and heart disease, which were the only three measures that we actually had accurate statewide rates to compare them to for the same age group. And so we also know that just from our experience that we tend to attract sicker than average populations to this program. So they do have a need for primary care. Now, what are they getting in terms of quality care? What you'd really like to know is, does it have a health impact? Now, I didn't put anything here on health impact because of two problems. One, that even with an average enrollment of 16 months, it's hard to measure how much impact 16 months of primary care has on eventual health outcomes. That's not a very long time frame. The other problem is that you just have a really hard time measuring health outcomes anyway for this population. So we haven't figured out a way to doing that. We're still working on that. But we do have one measure of quality that we believe tells us something about them. We looked at primary care network clients who received at least three primary care visits. This is using administrative data. And half of the primary care network clients were receiving at least three primary care visits within their first year. Then within those, who was three or more visits, we wanted to see how much how many of those visits were with the same provider or the same clinic? So of the half, 67% of those, that was the median measure of continuity. In other words, if you just said, okay, what percent of your visits was with the same provider, and then took the highest of all of those numbers, 67% was the median. So about half of them are getting two-thirds or more of their care with the same provider every year. Taking that one step further, what percent of them have at least half of their visits with the same provider? And that was 80%. So those are some interesting figures on continuity. Another of our goals was to look at cost. Cost is something that we collect a lot of data on because we have, obviously, administrative to claims data to look at this. Our focus was primarily on emergency room utilization. The percent of primary care network clients receiving an emergency room visit was 27%, and compared that to the non-traditional Medicaid population, which is 42%. The percent with the primary care visit before they went to the emergency room, so this is in some sense a measure of appropriateness. So is the person just going to the emergency room before they ever see a doctor? Well, under a primary care network, only 5% of the clients who received an emergency room visit had not seen a doctor before they went to the emergency room. In other words, they were relatively established in the healthcare system before they went to the emergency room. We also wanted to look at the appropriateness of the emergency room utilization, and here are some measures of appropriateness. I want to focus on three of those. The first one is the percent of emergency room visits that's due to injury. 33% for the primary care network versus 19% for non-traditional Medicaid. In other words, that's an indication of more appropriate use. Emergency rooms tend to be appropriate for injury than other things. Using Dr. Billings' algorithm from New York University, we also categorized some of our primary care, our emergency room visits. Those that were classified as non-emergent was only 23% versus 40%, and then the bottom one there, emergent but not primary care preventable, which is really why you think people should be going to the emergency room for injuries and other emergencies that are not primary care preventable or treatable. And on both of those, the primary care network clients were higher than the others. Finally, going back to our survey, what percent of the clients are actually using preventive care or routine care? Baseline, again, refers to the year before they came on the program. Only 50% were getting routine care. After year one, it rises to 72%, and it stays at 72% all the way through year two. Finally, what's next? So we've got the primary care network. We've been doing that for 4 years, but that does not answer all of our questions. Primary care network is a part of a larger effort to ensure all of Utah's citizens, as you heard earlier. Our goal is to have that number reduced by half by 2010 and then continue on beyond that. In October of 2006, we had another HIPAA waiver approved, which amends part of the primary care network 1115 waiver to allow us to create a program called the Utah Premium Partnership for Health Insurance, or UP. This is a premium subsidy that will allow primary care network eligible clients and CHIP-eligible children to use the state and federal funds. Instead of being on the government programs, they can take that money and use that as a premium assistance program through their employee-based health insurance. So I wish I had more to tell you, but it's only been operational for now. Today's the 20th, so we've got 20 days of experience, and we don't have any data after 20 days. But it is an option there. And then finally, we also are proceeding to find a way to ensure all of Utah's children and assist small businesses. And so I think you heard what Massachusetts did for that, and we've taken a look at those. Thank you.
Thank you, Norm. Up next is Jim Letty, who's a state senator from Vermont and the lead sponsor in that Senate of Vermont's health reform legislation. That legislation is also being phased in as we speak. A big chunk of it started on October 1st as well. Now, for 20 years, Jim Letty directed the Howard Center for Human Services in Burlington, Vermont. Nice ring to that, the Howard Center. That's not why we recruited him. Jim, thanks for coming, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Ed. Can you hear me? Okay. It's a little bit intimidating to come down here from Vermont. We don't even get the Federal Register in Vermont. So we may be ahead of the rest of you in that vein. You know, where to begin is really a challenging decision for me, because in some respects I think of this and reflect on the beginning lines of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And if we look at what is happening in technology, pharmaceuticals, longevity, there are some very positive, very exciting, and very rewarding benefits that are occurring in our healthcare system today. But at the same time, we have what could only be described as an explosion in the number of Americans who have lost their insurance, who are underinsured. We have an explosion in disease management in the area of diabetes and obesity. And in our children and our grandchildren, we have a train wreck coming at us in terms of their health and their future and the cost of providing health care to them. Now, we each see our health care from our own particular lens and point of view. My lens is reflected through 30 years, 20 years at the Howard Center, but 30 years of working with poor people, working with people who had no insurance for the most part, working with people who carried labels and stigma, working with people for whom there was very little difference between good times and bad times. And so when I look at healthcare and change and reform, I think first of those people. Why shouldn't they have quality health care and protection? But what I've learned is this, that no matter what my heart tells me, it is cost, not justice. It is cost, not equity. It is cost, not access, that is going to drive change. And the reason is quite simple. Justice has never been as urgent a motivating principle as insolvency. That is what we are facing. And I believe along with insolvency, there is another more basic, and frankly more fundamental truth, and it is this. All healthcare is personal. No matter what our background, no matter who we are, we look at these challenges ultimately, sooner or later, from the perspective of our own personal experience, our parents, our family, those we know. Increasingly, for more and more people, when we do and look at this, it feels more like a lottery, with more losers than winners. It often depends on where you work. It depends on whether you work. It depends on your age, whether you're old or young. Many Americans have been reduced to what amounts to a variation of social Darwinism. Survival of the wealthiest, the healthiest, and let's not forget the luckiest. The perfect storm is on the verge, and more of our citizens are being thrown overboard without life jackets. And it is in this sea of growing insecurity that the fear of more and more Americans is quite simply this. Will I be next? Will my family be next? In my view, it is a national embarrassment. It is a national embarrassment. Is Mike still on? And it is from this perspective that Vermont reached a point where we simply could wait no longer. We could wait no longer for Washington to ride to our rescue, for answers to come from elsewhere. So I created 2 years ago, along with the Vermont Business Roundtable, a coalition. A coalition of businesses, of labor, of healthcare providers, of low income, of disability groups, of insurers, of doctors, of hospitals. The only group not represented was government. And I believe that the answer and the pressure had to come from outside our beltway. And it had to come from the bottom up rather than the top down. And this coalition developed these six principles. And those six principles are incorporated verbatim in the preamble to our health care legislation. And by virtue of the work of this coalition, our legislation, I believe, was jump-started by at least a year. But let's get back to insolvency. For us to move forward, and this was a challenge, our overriding goal had to be to contain the steeply rising cost of health care. We approached these goals in three fundamental ways. First, we must cover the uninsured, and our numbers have increased by 50% in 6 years. Secondly, we cannot ignore, or we will fail, the plight of those with insurance, employers and those who have insurance. And finally, the heart of our plan is we must improve the quality and the value of health care. And the key here is follow the money. Follow the money. 75 to 80% of our expenses, as I'm sure yours are caught up in providing treatment and care for people with chronic conditions, often multiple chronic conditions. What we also learned is we weren't doing a very good job with those folks. They were only getting the type and level and quality of care they needed about half the time. So we built upon an initiative started by former Governor Dean and adopted and expanded by Governor Douglas. It's called the Blueprint for Health. We look at chronic care. We decided to really focus on that in a very organized way. The outline of what's wrong, you can look at it. You can agree or disagree. I don't think you can argue with where the costs are going. I think it's hard to argue with the outcomes or the poor outcomes that we're getting now. One of the things that we did in our chronic care program, we built into our legislation, is we have no co-pays and no deductibles. We want to eliminate barriers for people to get help. For those that argue that high deductible catastrophic plans will work, we say no, they won't. We cannot have more barriers in the way of people getting care that they need. In my view, the medical savings accounts type of plan work best when two conditions are satisfied. They work best if you have money and don't get sick. We don't think that applies to many of the people that we need to reach. The co-pays and deductibles will be waived. We think if we cannot succeed here, and we're in a very organized way with our medical society, with doctors, hospitals, insurance, the state, the Medicaid program, working in an organized way, if we do not succeed in making an impact on the quality of care and access to care with chronic conditions, we will fail. It's as simple as that. I'm not going to go over all of the ingredients of our bill. You've got them included in substantial detail, and I think with a fairly good explanation in your handout. Our financing is tied to, we believe if everybody is going to be covered, if everybody's in, everybody should pay a fair share. We are using tobacco monies, increasing our taxes on cigarettes. We also have an employer mandate. We weren't quite as smart as Massachusetts trying to figure out how to arrive at a number, so we just came up with how about a dollar a day. So ours is $365. We would have gone with an individual mandate because I believe that's the only way we're going to truly get universal coverage, but quite frankly, we did not have the means to do it. Our plan and our law will trigger in 3 years an individual mandate if we do not achieve at least 96% coverage. Finally, a couple minutes, wow, I was worried. I'd like to briefly make a couple of comments about what I hope can be lessons or for federal decision makers. And I know Alice is going to cover these, but I just want to say, I believe if we're going to move forward, At the federal level, you must understand the common denominator that all health care is personal. It's not just rules. It's not just benefits. It's not just a bunch of names and long legislation. All health care is personal, and our policy must reflect that. Secondly, if it was Brandeis who said it, I'll agree with it, that the states are the laboratories of democracy. That's the good news. But we must make sure they're laboratories of empowerment and not abandonment. My fear, as coming from a state working with poor people and disabled people, our federal government needs to empower. The fear I have now is we're on the edge of feeling just the opposite, that of being abandoned. One size does not fit all. States need flexibility, incentives. We need the elimination of barriers and bureaucratic obstacles, and we need sustainable funding. I also think we need national standards. Who's covered and what is covered? We have far too great a difference and disparity between eligibility and coverage between our states. I think that needs to be leveraged and influenced by our federal government. The Holy Grail, which I would term another way to refer to ERISA, it's a third rail. Whether we can do anything or not, I think it needs to be examined. Medicare and Medicaid must be made more compatible. If they aren't combined, they must be made more compatible. We have a two-class system of health care operated by our federal government. One Medicare, which is not means-tested, and which does far better, largely due to who the beneficiaries are, and the other Medicaid, which is quite a different program. The example, and the worst example, I believe, is the Medicaid Part D. In my judgment, it's nothing more than a political fig leaf, and I'm in the landing pattern for Part D. I'm 64 years old. If we do not recognize that in creating Part D, we created a donut hole, and we ignored the black hole of the uninsured, and we did nothing to deal with the issues of cost and the insolvency factor. A new benefit costing $600 billion at a minimum, as far as I know, did not extend coverage to one single uninsured person. It's unbelievable. Let me conclude with this. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Those words of Martin Luther King, spoken probably 40 years ago on another occasion with other issues, in my judgment, speak and ring as true then as they do, they should today, when it comes to providing health care for each and every one of our citizens. So thank you for having us here, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Jim. We're going to have one final panelist that will open it up for a discussion among our speakers and for you to get your chance to ask questions. And that final panelist is Alice Burton, Vice President of Academy Health here in town and Director of the State Coverage Initiatives Project at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is operated out of Academy Health. He's in close contact with state-level reforms and reformers across the country, and she's in a position to help us put reforms we've heard about so far into somewhat of a broader context. Alice, thank you for sharing your information.
Thank you. Sitting here listening to Senator Luddy talk, and I'm thinking, oh my, what a tough act to follow. And I'm thinking back to Amy's comments at the beginning where she talked about her 20, 30 slides talking about the Massachusetts plan. My challenge today is to talk to you about what 47 other states are doing. So I spent my weekend or last week cramming those slides down into six, which I've never accomplished before. We'll see how that works. So I'm going to give you a general picture of what's happening with states and their efforts on the uninsured. I think the first thing I'd like to say is certainly I have the impression, and I sense it in many state capitals and here in Washington as well, that states are raising hopes and raising expectations also that really action can happen on the uninsured. They're raising hope that bipartisan compromise is possible. And hopefully that can be a model for other states to act as well as national leaders to act. I will say that with bipartisan compromise, I would emphasize the word compromise, and really I think states have led the way in showing that really working through the difficult challenges of crafting a bill is really important. And so compromise is an important part of that phrase. What's happening in the states that are moving forward on comprehensive reform or are on less comprehensive, more targeted strategies to specific populations? I think several things. I think there are several ingredients there. One, leadership, and that's somewhat obvious and been in all of these states that we've talked about, but also an opportunity. And when I say that, I mean a potential, the several forces have come together, whether it be the potential loss of federal funds that might create an impetus for let's get together and come to some agreement on this because we don't want to lose federal financing for a program, or whether it be a maturing of a debate that's occurred over several years, or the coalition that Senator Leddy talked about, or new leaders coming in. There's some opportunity, some catalyst that makes reform possible in these states. And finally, and I think this is one that's often forgotten, particularly in this city, which is filled with policy analysts on every topic, and you've got 15 different policy shops on every nuance, that's not true at the state level. The state level, there are a few people in many states that do all the health policy work. And so to expect all states to be ready to act when there's opportunity and when there's leadership, I think we need to recognize we'll need to support some states in doing that, that they really do need analytic capacity to be able to evaluate the options to move forward and be able to act on those things. But certainly states are motivated to take on health reform, and we heard Senator Leddy's comment about they're not waiting for federal action anymore for moving forward, but also the realness of this problem, the real and growing problem that is so immediate at the state level. And they're trying a variety of different approaches, everything from these comprehensive approaches that really are market reforms and trying to reach a universal goal, or whether they're addressing a very specific and targeted population, such as working adults, working low-wage adults, or children, or different kinds of targets. What are the trends in state coverage initiatives? First, comprehensive state efforts really do take time. These things don't happen overnight. I think if you talk to any of these folks, they would tell you that a lot of this work was in development for many years. They build off prior efforts often, and they build off prior funding mechanisms. State doesn't wake up one day and say we've got 25% uninsured and set a goal of having comprehensive coverage the next year and have that be realistic at all. Really, all these states had done things in many cases to expand coverage before. In the case of Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maine, which we haven't talked about, but is another state with a very comprehensive proposal, all had lower rates of uninsured prior to putting their reforms in place. And they all had prior expansions, many different efforts, but prior expansions of public coverage where they already had funding in place to address the uninsured, many uninsured adults, far beyond what many other states have in place. They were building those reforms on those efforts. Most reforms, if not all, attempt to stem the erosion of employer-sponsored insurance, whether it's targeting small businesses and trying to help them to offer insurance, trying to find out what's going to be the right benefit package, the right cost structure to make it possible for small businesses to offer coverage, or to be putting in place an initiative that picks up the workers that aren't able to access employer-sponsored insurance, or the dependents of people who are working. But they're all about working families, largely, and trying to stem the erosion of insurance coverage for that population. This year in particular, we've seen that reforms often expect some shared financial responsibility, and some are even beginning to recognize the need for mandatory roles, whether it be on individuals or whether it be on employers, that really it's the mandatory nature of these programs that will get in participation in the programs, and that there's only so far you can go in terms of a goal of universal coverage with a voluntary program. Expansions in coverage often rely on private insurers to deliver services. I think this is an interesting one, and has a couple of you see states debating this. Even states that have Medicaid expansions that are doing something that's purely a Medicaid often are doing that through a private managed care organization or building it on a private platform or calling it something completely different and not calling it Medicaid. They may be using the Medicaid financing structure, but they're doing it through a very private mechanism and marketing it and branding it as a very private program. We've seen in a couple of states moving forward and trying to do that through private plans and trying to partner with private plans to hold the risk for these populations, but really a tension between an unknown population that we're trying to cover and the state maybe needing to hold some risk. So there are some examples where states are actually using the private delivery system but holding the risk for the insured population. Many state reforms address cost and quality in addition to health coverage. We've heard all of these previous speakers talk about the need to control cost. Most of the comprehensive reforms have different elements, a quality council, different initiatives to hold down cost, chronic disease management, that kind of thing. Six, voluntary purchasing pools as a standalone strategy are not likely to be sufficient to expand coverage. We heard Amy talk about the connector, and that is a buzz in state capitals. So let's put together a connector. Let's solve the problem of the uninsured by doing that. I think it's very important to recognize the history we have on these and to recognize what it is that Massachusetts is proposing. In Massachusetts, they are proposing a connector which will bring payers or purchasers together, but there's more to it than just that. There is a subsidy structure. There's the Section 125 plans, which Amy talked about, which are reasons to come to that connector. And I think we've been through the experience, many states have been through the experience, where they've tried just linking together payers to buy services, and there really needs to be a reason for them to come together. That subsidy is a very good reason. So looking forward, first, reforms take time, and we need to evaluate them over the long run. I said at the beginning that we're raising hope, and we're certainly raising expectation. For the panel that we do a year from now, I imagine we'll ask how many people are enrolled in all of these initiatives. And I would encourage us to recognize that the hard work has just begun for these states. They're now that they've got to compromise, they're now working towards implementation, and that's really, really the challenge. So I think that we need to evaluate these reforms over a period of time. Again, while we've raised hopes, we've also raised expectations. And I also want to say, while there's a lot of interest in states and a lot of states will act and will work on this energy for state reforms, I don't think it's reasonable to expect that all states will act. And the variation in terms of the uninsured across the states, Anne had some very helpful slides at the beginning, which point to the real diversity of this problem across the nation. So it's not reasonable to expect that state by state will be able to solve this problem of 47 million uninsured Americans. But what can we do from a federal level to encourage innovation and to see what happens at the states? I think we've heard it before amongst everybody that states will be the democracy, laboratories of democracy. So they'll test ideas both politically and practically. We'll learn about what's acceptable, what compromise can be achieved, and hopefully what we might be able to craft, but also what works and what doesn't at a practical level. Certainly, these state models may serve as models for other states, and other states will see pieces of what's working in these different states and take them to theirs and mold them to make them work for their own environment. But I also hope that they will be models for federal reforms. As many prior federal reforms have modeled on state efforts, I think there's an opportunity to do this. I think also we need to recognize that sustainable funding is essential for states to implement reforms. We've been through a number of exercises where we give states some money to do some planning efforts, and we say, go solve the problem of the uninsured, but we don't follow through with implementation dollars. And I think we need to recognize that for many states, the resources are such that if they're going to expand coverage and address the problem of the uninsured, there is the need for some sustainable federal financing. And finally, if we're going to pilot test a few things in a few states, we need to be prepared for them to be successful. And when they're successful, we need to be ready to enact those things, because I think it's going to be challenging for us to have a few states really leading the way with federal resources and moving forward on the uninsured and not helping the others to follow. So we really need to be prepared to follow through on the lessons that we learn from states and be able to act on federal reforms. With that, I think we've got questions. I'll turn it back to Ed.
Thank you very much, Alice. A good framing of the questions that arise as we hear from these states. Now we are at the point where you've joined the conversation. There are a number of floor mics. There are green question cards you can hold up and someone will pick them from you. And I invite Ann Gauthier as my co-moderator to join in as well. questions for any of the panelists. If the panelists want to ask each other questions, they should feel free to be able to do that too. Andy, you want to start us off?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I think I'll take us perhaps back into some of the interesting details that Amy did not have the opportunity to provide us with. And you talked about, as a critical theme, affordable coverage. And you talked about things that are being done structurally in the state, but you also talked about regulations for what will constitute an affordable plan in Massachusetts. So could you explain a little bit more about what elements of the law are being put in place to make insurance affordable, quote unquote, and how you see that playing out?
Well, a couple of clarifications. The individual mandate included in the law a feature that it was only applied to people for whom health care was affordable. So if it was deemed that health insurance wasn't affordable for that particular person or family, then they were exempt from the individual mandate. So it's really important to us that we make sure, if we're to be successful, that we make sure that the health insurance is affordable. The specifications for those affordable plans have not yet been determined. There's a council of the connector, the committee of the connector, it's made up of a board of 10, need to come up with the criteria and the specifications for what will constitute affordable coverage. But I think that they have been clear in wanting plans to be very creative in coming to that and not just look at the dials of increasing copayments and increasing deductibles, but actually look at things like tighter networks, look at things like disease management, look at things behavioral issues, compliance with doctor's orders, things like that, so that it's not strictly going to be, let's just turn the dials of copayment and deductible to get to that more affordable premium. The other issue that the state did take on is there were many councils developed and established through this law, 10, I think, in total, which meet on a monthly or more frequent basis that keep all of us state employees very busy. But they all have established a healthcare quality and cost council, which is made up of a number of people to look at developing mechanisms to make the healthcare system as a whole more efficient and better quality. So that will also be forthcoming.
Amy, can I just, following up, the council that you mentioned that's looking at the question of affordability, has the power to decide that question, or does the connector board have that power?
It's the connector board, yes. Excuse me if I said council. It's the connector board, which is a membership of 10, five ex officios and five appointed members that will establish that through regulation. There'll be public hearings on it. We've already heard from a number of people who have less comprehensive plans and are quite happy with those plans and want to keep those plans. And so I think it's going to be a really tough and difficult decision to come up with those standards.
Yes, I'd ask questioners to identify themselves and keep their questions as brief as they can.
Thank you. Stan Dorn from the Urban Institute. I have a question for Amy and a question for Norm. For Amy, I'd like to know your thoughts about using what you hope will be a large number of state residents covered through the connector as a means of leveraging lower premiums from insurance companies. And then my question for Norm is, you talked about the TANF parents who are losing some benefits and coverage to help fund services to single, to childless adults. Could you tell us a little bit more about what those cutbacks were and what the results have been in terms of your observation and evaluation? Thank you.
And I think the connector, some people call the connector a purchasing pool, and others stay far away from that terminology. So I think it's a little unclear how that will play out and how the connector will exert a market force, because they have a number of lives on the plans, to keep their premiums down. I think there's a lot of pressure, though, on plans right now. And so far, we've seen that they've come and met the levels of premiums that we had asked them to meet for the affordable products, for the products for under 300% of the FPL. They were well within the range that we were looking at pre-passage of the bill. So we're hopeful that that the connector will be able to exert at least some of that market pressure to keep the premium prices down.
In terms of the reduction in benefits for the TANF parents, it was thought that those should not get at the heart of medical care. So the changes in benefits were largely, the most important ones were increases in the copays, but not by very much. So, for example, some copays went from $2 to $3. It's not like we went to $25 or anything like that. There's also some services that were limited. For example, vision and dental under the new program had limits. It's kind of an irony in a certain sense, because when those were written into the waiver, those were viewed as benefit reductions. But right after that happened, the regular Medicaid adults lost them entirely. So within 2 years of the program starting, actually the non-traditional Medicaid clients actually had better benefits for vision and dental than regular Medicaid. There are also some limits placed on, for example, we did not cover or do not cover non-emergency transportation for TANF parents. Those are the sorts of benefits. In terms of impact, it's really hard to know. I mean, those are the sorts of things that you don't observe frequently enough to tell. Our previous study basically showed very little significant results, but that may be just due to the fact that we don't have enough power to measure them very well, as opposed to the fact that they didn't have much of an impact. One thing that we did notice was the increase in copays on pharmacy did result in a reduction in utilization rates for pharmacy, and that depends on who you talk to, whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. So there may or may not be negative results from the TANF population having their benefits reduced.
Norm, we've gotten a question here that I think follows that. Two questions. One is, why has enrollment in the primary care network been so low? I think I know the answer with your caps, but I'll let you get to that. But secondly, what happens to the enrollees in specialty care?
They're both very good questions. The so low is relative. We're a small state. 50,000, to us, that's a big number. We currently have 300,000 uninsured. So 50,000 people is a lot of people. The cap was initially set at 19,000 people, so that's how much money we had available for the program. Typically, you don't always have enough money to fund it at 19,000, so the average enrollment has been closer to about 17,000 in any given month. Sometimes it's lower than it, sometimes it's higher, just depends on where we are in the open enrollment cycle. But typically, when we have open enrollment periods, it fills up within just a couple of weeks. Whatever cap we set, we say, okay, enrollment's now open, and we try to gauge it. And usually the open enrollment periods have been around 2 weeks. We've had to limit those sometimes. Another strange thing is that we actually have two subpopulations. We have parents and childless adults, and we have to treat those separately because they have very different cost structures. So typically we have the parents tend to cycle out of PCN much more frequently than the childless adults, and so we're having open enrollment for them much more frequently. The second question was specialty care. Specialty care is not a covered benefit, so in other words, primary care network does not pay for that, but we have some wonderful networks of donated care, and we have two full-time workers in our office that help people arrange for donated or low-cost specialty care. We don't always get it. You don't always get specialty care. There are certain specialties that are just very, very hard to get into. Neurologist being one of those. It's very difficult for anybody, even if you have insurance, to get in to see a neurologist. So it just makes it even harder when you don't have insurance and you've got to rely on charity or donated care. But for the most part, specialists works on a charity care basis, and it works reasonably well. The caveat there is you just never know if you can't get into specialists what's going to happen. We've relied very heavily on our family practice physicians, and that's sort of a concern that we have, that sometimes we see the family practice physicians feeling responsible for providing care, even if it's a little bit beyond their ability. And so sometimes you see the family practice physician saying, look, I can't get you in to see a neurologist, but I'll do the best I can, and I will treat you the best I can with the skills that I have. And that may not be exactly the best for everything. But by and large, people are getting, for the most part, care that they need to get.
Yes, Jim? I'd just like to make a comment on the last reference to the importance of primary care. We absolutely believe that they are the foundation and will be the key to whether or not we are going to succeed. And we have a challenge in our state, and I think increasingly in the smaller and more rural states, if not throughout the country, of having a declining pool of primary care physicians. We need to address that, and I think the federal government needs to pay some attention in terms of how support can be provided to students going through medical schools, for example. My daughter just graduated from medical school, We call her Doc now. And she's doing her residency in Boston. She went to the University of Vermont. In-state tuition, we have a family foundation that provides $40,000 over 4 years to Vermont kids going to medical school, which is incredible. She came out with a six-figure debt. Most of her classmates came out with $250,000 worth of debt. What that is doing is two things. It's driving them geographically where it's more attractive, and it's driving them into specialties that pay them more. And we doubled the loan repayment part of our budget. We think it's a step, but it's inadequate. We need to look at where our providers are going to come from and, frankly, provide subsidies and incentives to get them.
Very good. Yes, in the back, please.
Chris Peterson with CRS. A question for Norm and Amy as well. Norm, do you think that enrollees in the new primary care program consider themselves to be insured? And the reason that I ask is I do estimates on the uninsured, and I'm just curious as to what the impact will be on those estimates as a result of that program and whether it's appropriate. And then for Amy specifically, I'd like for you to talk about your SCHIP piece of Massachusetts plan. And if I'm not mistaken, I think you've exhausted your federal SCHIP funds for 06 and are projected to do so for 07. I don't know if that's not too big of a concern for the state because you have Medicaid funds to fall back on when those SCHIP funds are exhausted, but just wanted to get the opportunity. Talk about that.
In terms of we do a state survey of health insurance status, and we specifically ask under the question, do you have insurance? We say, are you on Utah Medicaid? Are you on CHIP? Are you on the primary care network? So we don't really get an opportunity to see whether that person considers the primary care network to be insurance, but could we count it in terms of, like, it's an answer on the question, are you on Medicaid, are you on CHIP, are you on primary care network, et cetera. And so that is one of the categories that we do track in the surveys. In terms of the individuals, when we've done the surveys of them, most of them view the primary care network as providing a significant benefit and significant access to what it does do. We do have a certain percentage who feel like that they didn't know what they were getting into, that they thought they were getting comprehensive care, and they were surprised later to find out that they didn't. And if that's a marketing issue, just letting them know that, look, we've done some changes in the enrollment materials to let them know in big letters, you are not getting this, you are not getting this. And so that has been a marketing issue for us as well as helping people understand what the program does and does not do.
I can't answer your question specifically. I know that there was an issue with that and that we had to reclassify some of the kids that were under our SCHIP, under our ordinary Medicaid program. I don't have the details on that, but I can get that for you. But it's not an issue moving forward.
Yeah, can we take one more question in the back from someone who was in line before the gentleman in front?
Hi, Eva Dugoff with Representative Jan Schakowsky's office. I have a quick question for Norm, which is, you mentioned that 54% of people left the primary care network for other insurance. Do you know why the other 46% of people left your program?
Yeah, we did. We asked some follow-up questions for those that did not leave for insurance. There were just a mixed bag. There's really not one good answer to that. There was kind of even representation of I didn't feel like I was getting value for what I was paying, which was $50 a year, so it's hard, you know, somebody wasn't getting value for their $50 a year. There were a lot of people who said that. There were a lot of people who said that they didn't understand the re-enrollment process. So when we had that happen, we actually kept track of those survey respondents and recontacted them at the next open enrollment to see if they wanted to re-enroll. So some of them may have actually come back on if they understood that it was missing. We did have a surprising number who said that the $50, coming up with $50 once a year was a problem for them. And we don't really have a good solution for that because we feel like it's important for there to be some sort of participation. But it's really hard to know how you pitch that in a way that doesn't cut somebody out. I mean, there's always going to be somebody at the margin. And there were a surprising number that said that $50 every year was a problem for them coming up with that amount of money.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Matthew Blake. I am a reporter with the Capital Times, Madison, Wisconsin. Referring to the title of this presentation, Lessons for Federal Policymakers, I was wondering if the panel does generally support the Baldwin-Price bipartisan health care reform bill.
In case you're not familiar with that, there is a description in your packets. And in the Senate, it's a Bingaman-Voinovich bill. Anybody want to take that on?
To give grants to states to expand coverage as well as to do some other reform.
I'll start with that one. I'm not going to take a position on the bill. I don't have one. I think that there are key elements of what it takes for the federal government to encourage reform in terms of states, and I talked about that a little bit. I think it's important to give them money for implementation, and that implementation needs to be over a period of time. It can't be a one-year pot of money with a cliff on the other end of it. For a state to be invested to develop a strategy, they need a sustainable funding source to be able to move forward on that. And I think with that is the recognition that once those states are able to move forward, if they are able to move forward with those kinds of things, that a number of other states will want to follow. So again, demonstrations of this nature can really help to show what different things can work, but I think there needs to be a readiness to act on what works after that's shown.
Go ahead, Ann.
I don't have the detail. I've read sort of summaries of what has been proposed. But again, I would encourage it, but I would have caution if it doesn't move beyond tinkering, I would question it. If it doesn't have incentives for states and other states to follow, but most importantly, it needs sustainable funding. Since the early 1980s, when we moved essentially to block grant types of funds, increasingly the federal government has found itself providing pilot projects, research-oriented grants, 3-5 years and out. And what that does is it discourages states and others from applying because even if they succeed, they're faced with the incredible challenge of trying to find the ongoing funding. And so I don't have the detail, but if these proposals offer those types of incentives, obviously I think they would be positive, and hopefully they would serve as examples for other states.
Go ahead.
If I could ask a follow-on, as perhaps Amy might want to chime in here and Norm as well, to what degree would a bill such as a bill that provides significant funding for some number of states help to break the partisan logjam that you have faced or you might face in moving ahead more significantly? And to what degree would it impede or would it do nothing?
Yeah, I think you are all aware that we don't have a partisan logjam in Utah. We have one party that controls the governorship and a veto-proof majority in both houses. So we don't have that problem. We have a different one. We have an ideological logjam, which is generally our problem, is just finding something that's acceptable to all of the factions within that party. So I think I maybe would prefer to just comment generally. Our leadership in our state is very supportive of the concept of states being laboratory for democracy, of finding ways, trying what works for different states. What works in Massachusetts may not end up working in Utah and vice versa, but there may be some things that we find out that we all have in common. And so if there is going to be some sort of federal guidelines, those probably should be widely tested in states first, because otherwise you end up taking something that may only work in a subset of states and trying to apply that to all states, and that ends up being worse than where you started, which was just allowing states to do something different on their own.
Thanks.
Yes, sir, in the back.
I think this question is most germane to the smaller states, geographically speaking. I'm sorry, my name is John Rigg. I'm with the Committee on Ways and Means. This is more applicable to the smaller states, I think, geographically, not so much population, so specifically targeted towards the Vermont and Massachusetts people among the panelists. And that is, it's a question more of geography. We have a number of small states that are highly urbanized, they're packed closely together, and it's very easy to live or work on or near the border of one state. To what extent are you concerned about geographic variations crossing state lines? If I work in Massachusetts and live in another state, to what extent are the Massachusetts healthcare regulations applicable to me, and is that addressed in the law? Secondarily, is there a state or is there a federal role in helping the states to sort of regulate these sorts of things? And what would you envision that federal role as being?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And the law as it pertains to employers is for employers that are located in Massachusetts for all their employees. So they're required to do the tests of fair share and free rider apply to all their employees. And the individual mandate applies to those residents that live in Massachusetts. But we had to make those decisions, and we'll see. There definitely is creep of both employers and residents across those borders, particularly New Hampshire and Rhode Island, New York. So we'll have to see if those are the right decisions. But those were specifically made in the statute.
Jim?
We had similar issues and concerns raised. Actually, there are some folks who thought that if we passed this law that the entire western shore of Lake Champlain would move, which is New York, would move to Vermont. And we had some concern about that. The reality is that a state that leads, other states are going to follow. We our benefits in Vermont in many areas are decidedly better than our neighbors to the east, New Hampshire. And we have seen no migration of folks from New Hampshire to come to Vermont to receive our benefits. We have our second largest hospital in Vermont, serving Vermont residents, is in New Hampshire, Dartmouth-Hitchcock. They have 5,000 employees, 2,500 are Vermont residents. So there's a lot of movement back and forth. We think that if our program succeeds, other states will follow. We also think our businesses that will regard this as an economic benefit to them, helping them recruit and retain workers. So it's a question, but we don't see it as a major obstacle.
Alice?
I would just add that, I mean, while we're seeing more state innovation happen right now and the potential for more variation, even with the panelists today, we've got tremendous variation across the states in what they're proposing to do. But we already have tremendous variation across the states. If you looked at a chart of just eligibility levels in the Medicaid program, particularly for adults, you'd see how very, very different it is across the nation. And so the question really is a national question. How much variation are we really willing to accept? And I think it also lends to how much then flexibility are we willing to offer? And is that flexibility for states to try new things with populations that haven't previously been covered? Is that flexibility more acceptable than a different kind of flexibility? I think it raises really all of those questions as the federal debate happens about how much of this will be encouraged at the state level versus a broader national solution.
Before we take your question, two things. One is remind you that blue evaluation form is sitting right on top of the left-hand side of your briefing materials, and I'd appreciate it if you'd grab hold of it here. We have about 15 minutes or so left of our time here. And there's a question that has recurred. There are a couple, actually, but one I wanted to make sure got asked before we got too far along, addressed directly to Alice Burton, although if the other folks want to chime in, they can. Could you please describe the Illinois plan to cover all kids and talk about the progress of that plan?
Sure. Last year, I believe it was, Illinois passed legislation to expand coverage to all children in their state. And this happened on the heels of several other things that the state of Illinois had done, again, building on prior investments in coverage. Illinois was one of the few states to expand their Medicaid program to parents at a time when most states were at least looking at reductions in that in a severe fiscal crisis. So as they did that, that was a platform in terms of expanding coverage. This latest expansion was for all children, building on top of the SCHIP program, essentially uninsured children in families with much higher incomes of any income really can apply to coverage. They pay for that coverage on a sliding scale, so therefore more likely we'll have enrolled those that are likely to get a richer benefit from that, those right up above the SCHIP eligibility levels. in the state. So Illinois was the first to do this boldly with the term all kids is the name of their program. But several other states are talking about that. I think, Norm, you mentioned it in your state. Pennsylvania has at least passed budget authority to do a similar type program. And a number of other states have different kinds of strategies that are calling for all kids types of programs, whether they be explicitly building on an S-CHIP framework or whether they be the goal of universal coverage for children achieved through multiple different mechanisms.
Let me jump in there really quick. One of the reasons why we are including all kids in our proposal moving forward is it's affordable. We can ensure all kids who are currently eligible for CHIP and Medicaid for around $12 million more a year ongoing funding. That's a drop in the bucket compared to the entirety of the problem. All that would leave us is with kids over 200% of the federal poverty level. There are only about 12,000 of those. And again, it's doable. It's a doable proposition to focus on that group. It's affordable, and you can actually get your hands around that size of a problem.
I just had another thought on that. We've spent years also years of SCHIP improving our outreach and eligibility. And really, I think many of us recognize that one of the components of reaching the uninsured was reaching those that are eligible but uninsured. The All Kids programs makes that message so much clearer. It makes the message of enroll in our programs a lot simpler. So I think it builds on the point that Norm makes that's an inexpensive population, but also builds on the really great experience and great work that states have done to improve outreach and enrollment in programs like that.
And I think most of the people in this room may know that one of the major issues facing Congress next year is the reauthorization of the SCHIP program, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot of debate about whether to reauthorize as is or use it as a platform for potentially reaching more uninsured kids. So we'll all be working with you to think through those issues.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Howard Tuck. I'm a physician and Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow in town. And this is really a question for the state folks. With all of the flexibility and innovation, do you have enough of a mechanism and ability to evaluate the outcomes of the changes that are there? Can we learn from the state experiments adequately to really develop a greater understanding at the federal level? And is there a federal role for encouraging a more standardized approach to the evaluations of the experiments and the innovations that you're creating?
Very good questions.
I'm not sure. We certainly took the issue very seriously and have built into our legislation a number of steps to evaluate various parts of it, including the outcomes of our chronic care initiative. That's very much a part of that overall effort. The investment in technology, which I did not mention, is key to our implementation of a program as well as the ability to evaluate it. I think that we're going to need help. We're going to need help from the government and perhaps from foundations. I think we need to have more universal forms of evaluation so that you can look across states and come up with information that then can be replicable if they're working. But I think your question is a fair one. If we succeed only in expanding coverage without addressing the issue of quality, we likely will fail as well.
I think our experience is similar. We found that it's relatively straightforward to evaluate participation and utilization. When it comes to health outcomes, we have the same problem that every health services researcher has. It doesn't go away just because you're looking at an experimental program. It's really hard to measure the outcomes to start with, and it's even harder to associate health outcomes with the program.
And with my foundation hat on, I'll jump in. One of the reasons that we and other foundations have been asked to fund evaluations is because there isn't state or federal funding currently available to ask and answer the types of questions, not only about health outcomes, but about how people's lives are different, what is different in the care that they get, and a number of other questions. So we have very small funding in comparison to the needs. Ideally, it would be a federal role, but money has been tight for such things for some time at this point.
Yes.
Hi, I am Geraldine Drake Hawkins with the National Council on Disability. I want to commend Vermont because I heard that you, in your statement, are including people with disabilities in the work you're doing. My question to the other states would be whether or not you have some kind of initiatives that will allow you to have data at the end that you could disaggregate in some way so that people with disabilities will have some notion of how things may be working in your states. There may be some lessons for us at the federal level. And another part of my question, or maybe another question is, yeah, it is another question, whether or not in any of the programs that you, the initiatives at the state level, anyone is looking at and collecting data around mental health. Thank you.
Alice, or Jim, whichever you'd like.
Well, mental health, obviously, Vermont's parity law, which includes substance abuse, it was passed in 1997. For many folks would still look at it as probably the most progressive in the country, and yet it is not as successful as we would like. We have the inclusion of folks with mental illness and the whole area of mental health is a growing area that we're looking at in Vermont, and I think across the country in terms of links to mainstream health care. I use that term because I can't think of another one. But we have some real problems in Vermont that we're struggling with some serious issues of quality around the care of the mentally ill in our state hospital. And so that is getting particular emphasis, but it is not directly related to our legislation. It's getting that emphasis because it should occur under any circumstances.
Alice?
I would just actually tie your question back to the earlier one about evaluations. You sort of pointed out the large challenge of understanding how these different initiatives work for different populations. It's one thing to look at them overall. It's quite another thing to look at how they affect discrete different populations of individuals with different kinds of needs. So it's an evaluation challenge, I think, in going forward. Your question about mental health, I would say that in most of the states that I've worked with in looking at coverage initiatives, one of the questions that often comes up is what will the benefits be what will an affordable benefit package be and how to change that. And clearly mental health is a part of the discussions in many of those states. And if not, then if they're not included in a new benefit package, how are those costs covered? Are they covered already through the state general funds? And really, is that an efficient way to do that? So I think that mental health is very present in the discussions with state leaders about how benefits will be structured and how we'll be paying for them one way or the other.
Can I slip in a couple of it's a single question that was written in different ways on several different cards, and it has to do with ERISA and the Massachusetts plan for requiring employers to set up Section 125 plans. And I guess my threshold question, Amy, is if you could define 125 plans for us really quickly, but then explain whether or not those requirements are being challenged under ERISA, if they could be, and whether employers were upset enough about the fair share requirements that they would challenge on that ground.
Sure. The Section 125 plan is a part of the IRS code that allows for, at least what we were referring to is the part that allows for the pre-tax payment of the premiums to allow your employees to have access to that benefit. Because we are not requiring employers to contribute towards that, they are that requirement is just to set up that plan. It is not subject to, at least our opinion is, it's not subject to an ERISA challenge. It's possible we could get an ERISA challenge on some of the other pieces of the law, such as the fair share, but we have not to date that I'm aware of. And I think part of that is tribute to the way the businesses actually came together and worked through this law before it became law and helped contribute towards it and felt that they were a part of it and felt that along the way, we've listened to them and tried to craft the regulations so that it wasn't too onerous or burdensome on employers. So, I mean, there still could be an ERISA challenge to come, but there hasn't been one to date.
Jim,
I would also just point you to a reference in your packet. There's an issue brief that the National Academy of State Health Policy and State Coverage Initiatives, the program I'm involved with, in just commissioned with Pat Butler, an attorney who does a lot of work on ERISA, and it goes through those issues and talks about specifically the 125 plan exemption and that there is some Department of Labor ruling that the Section 125 plans are essentially outside of the ERISA exemption. But I would encourage you to look at that brief, much more technical than my answer here.
I just comment that in Vermont, on the so-called employer mandate, our experience was quite similar to Massachusetts. We had involved the business community from day one in terms of my establishment of this Coalition 21. They really worked cooperatively. They did not like some parts of it. What was interesting at the end is that while no business group came out in support of an employer mandate on those not providing insurance, many of those providing insurance said thank you, quietly, thank you, at long last. So one of the fastest growing areas of cost shift, in my experience, is between employers. And those that are offering good benefits increasingly are frustrated by carrying cost from those that don't. And if you have a husband and wife working two different places, there's a choice being made as to where the benefits are going to be taken. And more employers are starting to define and limit the benefits offered to dependents, largely because of the cost shift and the increasing burden on them. So we really had, if not support in a public way, we didn't have any real opposition at the same time.
Very good. Yes, ma'am, you've been very patient.
Hi, my name is Melissa Amdell. I'm from the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, and my question is for Senator Leddy. I noticed that you mentioned that there were no copayments and no deductibles for the Vermont plan, and I was wondering if there were any mechanisms that you had in place or if there was any concern on your part about the financial sustainability of the program. I know several states recently have had to go from no copayments and no deductibles on their Medicaid programs to copayments and deductibles because there was some waste and abuse in the system. Did you guys look at those states, and do you have anything in place to prevent that?
Well, first of all, the copayments or the lack thereof and also of deductibles applies to folks who are enrolled in a chronic care management program. It relates to that part of the care. And what we believe is that we did not want to have obstacles to people getting care. And we believe that in many cases with high deductibles, catastrophic types of plan, or even deductibles and copays even more modest, for a lot of people, those are reasons why they don't get the care. And we wanted to remove those. We also, with our Medicaid population, for folks who pay premiums there, our studies indicate that about half of our uninsured in Vermont are people who are Medicaid eligible. And we believe that one of the reasons is many of them might be healthy, young, but we also think another is might be the cost of those premiums. We actually, with our Dr. Dinosaur program, which is our children's program funded through Medicaid, we reduced the premiums by 50% there. We reduced them for adults who are paying premiums by 30%. So we actually went the opposite direction because we weren't afraid of people ripping us off. We want to eliminate, where possible, barriers to people getting care. And we feel that if they get quality care early and well, then we're going to achieve the savings in dollars, and we're going to have a healthier population.
Good question.
What we were talking about before with one proposal, I'd ask any of the panelists here, what could Congress do that would facilitate the efforts that you are currently undertaking? Aside from writing a check, yeah.
While you're thinking about your answer to that, let me just, I picked up a phrase from one of the pieces in your packets. It was a one-pager, an executive summary from the New American Foundation, asserting that state reform should be here I quote, catalytic and exemplary to, not substitutes for, national reform. So if you want to weave a comment on that observation into your response to Ann's question, that would be a fitting way to bring this program to an end. Jim, you want to start off? You look anxious to tell us what
well,
you should do.
There's a couple of comments. First of all, encourage us. Encourage us. Get rid of the barriers, if you can, from our federal government. Look at the progress that states have made, that generally in my state at least, we have a Democratic legislature and a Republican governor. We had very serious differences, I think we still do, but we made progress. The worst feeling I've ever had in my life in anything I've ever done was to get down to the 12th hour on health care legislation and feel that I was playing a game of chicken with the health care of the people of Vermont. And that has to end. That has to end at our federal level, and it has to end at our states. We cannot polarize and politicize the health of our country and of our citizens by playing games of political chicken.
I know I should have an answer for this, given the title of this whole meeting, but I guess I would agree with Senator Leddy in that, you know, support for the states, not just financial, but encouragement, and also maybe some initial investment in helping us to evaluate our reform efforts through either additional survey dollars or other dollars to help us really take a good look at whether what we're doing is working or not.
Our experience has generally been positive, that we've found very receptive, but sometimes you just run into strange requirements that are hard to explain. For example, with the premium subsidies, that they have to be, we have to write a check to a person, we can't write a check to their employer, and we can't write a check to the insurance company. And the answer is that's just the way it is. It's not like anybody has any discretion to do that, but it is a problem for us in exactly doing things that we would like to do. And we appreciate the people in the federal government helping us work through all those issues, but there are some little things. I guess that's just a legislative issue. And it's very difficult to get things like that corrected in the federal setting, so I don't know how you do that.
I'd just add to this. I think that if we're at a place where we're expecting states to lead the way, if that's where we are and we want states to be doing things, then Norm's absolutely right. There needs to be flexibility on some of these administrative nuances, which are not such nuances when you go to implement programs. They really can be barriers to doing things that make sense. So if that's where we want to be, if we want to be at a place where states are going to lead the way and do this, we need to be open to the flexibility that comes with this. We've all talked about the funding that's necessary for states to do this. But again, I'll end with, while these states are raising hope, I think New America is absolutely right. We should not let this raise an expectation that state by state we can solve this problem one by one state and have any sort of uniform policy, that really there are some states that will not be able to act. I think that's partly why we struggle to answer this question a little bit here, because there's some key ingredients that need to exist at a state that can't with simply a federal grant program. There really needs to be a broader solution if we really expect to solve it.
I would say amen to that.
I know you mean that in the most bipartisan way. Well, we've learned a lot of lessons, I think, in this discussion, both political and policy, and in keeping with Jim's observation about the nature of healthcare, personal as well. I know that this discussion is perfectly in keeping with the Alliance's mission of seeking solutions to the problems of uninsured and high costs in healthcare, not necessarily along any ideological lines, but with an urgency that is too seldom reflected in the discussions that we're sometimes part of here. And with that, I'd like to take this chance to thank Commonwealth Fund, both Ann and Karen Nelson, and the rest of the staff, the Alliance staff, for putting together a wonderful program and materials. Thank you for being part of one of the more spirited discussions we've had on this topic, I think, in the last couple of years, and ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an incredibly rich discussion about what we might be able to do in the next couple of years. Thank you.